Good morning. My name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. This morning's guest on With Respect is Bob Mueller. Until recently, Bob was the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation for the United States and with its range all across the United States and around the world. With Respect, Bob Mueller, for a second visit in which we'll be talking about the future world after 9/11. And after Bob took over the FBI. With respect, John Smetanka, with Bob Mueller. Bob, how are you this morning?
Good, John. And how are you?
I'm doing fine. As I say, the weather here is taking a break, and we have many of our dogs and cats who are outside and frozen into ice castles and stuff are now thawing, and we have to see them again.
You mean you're telling me it's 10 degrees up there and you're happy?
If it gets up to 10, we're really happy. I mean, that's a heat wave. Oh, yeah. Lots of snow. We didn't not as much as we had last year, but this year is still we're making up for lost time. Bob, when we last talked, now, you know, you were not only a friend, which you may regret someday, you were an assistant U.S. attorney. You were a Marine. You were an advisor to Attorney General Dick Thornburg. You were, in fact, deeply involved in the work of the Department of Justice, with stints out in private practice. And so you got a chance before September 4th of 2001. You had a chance to see a lot of different high-powered people, high-powered events which changed your life and our world to some extent. But I'm going to say that probably no event has changed our world nearly so much as the event called 9/11, in that we finally became aware of the concerted and the organized effort to create terror as a manner of changing the world, brought to our shores, which hadn't happened perhaps for ages. So, Bob, we talked about in our last show the sort of the history not only of yourself and your own involvement in justice, but the history of the FBI and how it developed many different functions as the challenges of society brought to it. But 9/11 focused our attention, and it focused the attention of not only the people, but the government itself, as to how do we react to people trying to destroy us. What happened after 9/11, and where do we go from here? Where do we go from that date and on through today?
Well, let me start with what we had felt we had to do after 9/11 to respond to that horrendous attack. And there were three components that what changes we initiated, and to a certain extent, the changes we initiated back then are applicable to facing other threats in the future. And first of all, we had to prioritize, and really prioritize. I mean, the first thing we did was make counterterrorism number one priority, counterespionage number two, and protecting the United States from cyber attacks number three. On the criminal side, it was public corruption and civil rights, because if we do not investigate, they do not get investigated. Transnational, international, organized crime, still a huge issue. White-collar crime and violent crime. And those were the priorities for each of our special agents in charge of our 56 field offices. And they were told that they had to address those priorities in order, and we put in place mechanisms whereby we would periodically sit down, generally in video conferences, and go through what each of the offices had done to address those priorities. We moved 2,000 agents from the criminal side of the house to the national security side of the house. They basically came from the drug programs and the smaller white-collar crime cases that we had. Those priorities we looked at over a period of time, and since then, and they remain the priorities today. Secondly, we had to develop an intelligence capacity. We had analysts, not necessarily very well trained. We went from 1,000 analysts to 3,000 analysts, understanding that our task was to anticipate an attack and not gather evidence after an attack. And the distinction between gathering a fact, which may or may not be evidence, was one that we hadn't had to grapple with before. We had to develop facts that would paint a picture of a scenario which would enable us to identify those persons who undertake attacks. The third area is in terms of partnerships. We had to break down the walls between ourselves and the CIA, exchange information, and make certain that the decision makers in the White House and elsewhere had a complete picture of threats from overseas and domestically, and not being separated and walled off as they had been before, but have the complete picture of threats to the domestic United States from overseas. And part of that component in terms of partnerships was making certain that we enlisted the support and the friendship and the contributions of state and local law enforcement. So we grew to about 100, I think the last count I had was 104 joint terrorism task forces around the United States, which were populated by certainly FBI agents. We were the administrative heads, other federal agencies, but most particularly state and local law enforcement entities. And that's the apparatus we put into place in the wake of September 11th to meet the challenges that we saw arising out of September 11th.
All right, Bob, at this point I want to talk about, because this is the most relevant to the in your organization, it's most relevant to what we're going to be talking about. The FBI is not just agents going around sniffing out leads from informants and putting together reports and then delivering it to prosecutors. That's one function which I think everybody who's watched television and listened to the radio over the years thinks is what the FBI does. But you have many other responsibilities and personnel. Now, you mentioned intelligence analysts, but let me go down the line. You've got how many agents out in the FBI when you total employees, I should say, for the FBI?
Total employees now, when I left, was about 34,000-35,000.
And what was it when you took over?
About 27,000.
Now, you have, in addition to people who are called special agents, and they are, what is a special agent, by the way?
A special agent has the arrest powers, principally. Has the investigative capabilities and is the heart and soul of the Bureau. That does not mean that the analytical cadre, the other professional staff, I don't equally contribute, but it is the American public comes face-to-face with the special agent most often.
All right, what about the support staff? What kind of different support personnel do you have?
Well, we have a range. We have bomb techs. We have we now in this day and age we have computer scientists. We have persons with backgrounds in weapons of mass destruction. I did mention cyber with our computer scientists and the like. We have a behavioral science entity that is fairly well known through the movies and the like. to better enable us to solve crimes, but also anticipate terrorist attacks. We have legal attachés, as we call them, which are agents that are stationed overseas. We now have over 60 overseas stations in various embassies. We contributed substantially to, both through special agents and others, to the efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan in advising the governments of those countries as to how you conduct major investigations free from corruption. We just have a range of responsibilities around the world now that has grown exponentially since September 11th.
One of the things that the FBI is well known for and has been for decades is that you have a national laboratory, and that performs a lot of different functions. What tell us about the national laboratory that you have?
Well, our laboratory has been around for, it was one of the great contributions that Hoover made, certainly in probably the 60s. Actually, elements of it probably predate the 60s and last. In the last century, but it does things like DNA, fingerprints, all of the forensics that that one needs, whether it be for intelligence purposes or for purposes of bringing criminals to justice. It's grown over a period of time, and I think people would say that it is the leading laboratory of its like in the world. Reconstruction. It helps in reconstructing the Pan Am 103 plane. The identifying and fingerprinting, and I'll use fingerprinting for explosive devices, understanding and trying to understand who is the maker and where is the maker of a particular type of explosive device. All of those are elements of the laboratory. We also quite obviously have substantial responsibility for running the DNA nationwide capability and networks and databases, as well as fingerprint databases.
You also have something else that you mentioned, which is the psychological prediction units. That is, that they try to identify criminals before they commit crimes.
To a certain extent, yes. So that is difficult to do, but it gives us guidance. Behavioral science gives us guidance in a number of ways. If you're in a confrontation situation where you have hostage taken, for instance, we would go to the behavioral science unit and say, okay, what motivates this person? How do we, before we send the SWAT teams in, before we send in what we call hostage rescue team, what can you tell us about this individual? How should we approach it? And their insight and their background is tremendously helpful in resolving those situations. We use them for all sorts of purposes. Over a period of time, they've compiled studies of a number of serial killers in the hope and expectation that we would be better able to identify serial killers, but also anticipate serial killers.
That tells me also that you have you use the word intelligent analyst, intelligence analysts. That tells me that they're looking for things, patterns, and predicting, but also analyzing past events. What are the intelligence agents or analysts in your bureau doing?
Well, there are a number of things they do. One of the things as opposed to the metrics being the number of indictments, number of arrests, indictments, and convictions, which have been the traditional metrics for the Bureau as well as prosecutors, our metrics now are what is a threat, identifying a threat. What is a threat in a particular community? It could be a series of homicides. It could be gang activity. But identifying a particular threat and then identifying what we know about that threat, and more particularly what we do not know about that threat, and then setting out requirements to fill the gaps, whether it be through witnesses or sources or wires, court-ordered intercepts, forensics, or surveillance, utilizing all of those tools to fill those gaps, to paint a picture of the threat and devise a strategy and tactics therefrom to eliminate that threat. And that role that the analysts play is critical now for us being effective and address and utilizing our resources to address the priorities that I articulated.
One of the things, the two words that you used, which are now causing a tremendous amount of discussion and controversy in the United States, in other words, electronic surveillance. Now that, you know, the fear is that we have too much intrusion by government into the private lives of innocent citizens, or even guilty citizens, people who are planning bad things. The question is whether or not we should be able to use electronic surveillance to invade private discussions. The second...
Let's
take a break right now. We'll come back and we're going to talk about how electronic surveillance fits in, not only with intruding into people's lives, but rather helping people's lives. We're talking to Bob Mueller, who is the recently retired director of the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation. This is John Smetanka, and our program is With Respect. Now back on With Respect with Bob Mueller, the recently retired director of the FBI. He was director for, I believe, 12 or 13 years, which puts him up there as the second longest, I believe, of the directors of the FBI. This is John Smetanka. Bob, when we broke, I tossed out those two words that have caused so much ink and television time and demonstrations and fears and promise all around this country and around the world. Electronic surveillance. All right. The ability of electronics to expand our world, to allow us to email our friends, to use it for business, for research, the internet, all of this is part of what you do. I mean, that's the part of the world that you use to gather intelligence. To gather information so you can do what you need to do about predicting problems or catching the people who committed bad acts. How do you balance the two, Bob? This is something which is troubling everybody.
Well, I'll start out by saying it's absolutely essential that we are able to intercept communications of those who would commit terrorist attacks. You've got two ways of addressing terrorism. One is through sources, individuals who are close to the center and can pick up information that would enable you to prevent terrorist attacks or intercept communications. In the United States, we can only intercept the substance of communications through a court order in the criminal arena, or in the national security arena. In the criminal arena, each of the federal courts and the 90-plus districts around the country, the judges give approval to prosecutors to intercept communications upon an appropriate showing. Same thing in the national security arena with the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court. We are, as far as I can tell, the only country that requires its prosecutors and its investigators to get a court order to intercept the substance of communications. John, you've been a prosecutor. You know the packages that we put together to show probable cause in order to enable a judge to approve an order for an interception for a limited period of time and for particular purposes. That is left out of the dialogue. I am comfortable with that that requirement, and very comfortable in making a showing of probable cause that a person is affiliated with a terrorist group to an independent entity such as the FISA court in order to accomplish that.
FISA is the acronym for Foreign Intelligence Surveillance.
Surveillance, yes. If you go to the UK, if you go to Sweden, if you go to Norway, if you go to the Scandinavian countries, if you go to France, if you go to Spain, or you go to Germany, the prosecutors and the investigators are under no similar constraints. There may be bodies that review their activity after the fact, but no other country has that requirement that we make a showing of probable cause to a court, an independent court, in order to be able to undertake that intrusion. And I agree it is a substantial intrusion entailing the interception of conversations between persons.
There are organizations and people in the United States and elsewhere, and I travel in Europe a lot, and so I know that the reaction of the, say, the British and some of the other European countries is, oh, my God, you people, you snoop on everything. But there are people, pardon me, there are agencies in the United States or groups in the United States who say, oh, yeah, that's what they say, that this, but, you know, it's, yeah, that's the law, but they break the law anyway. And the whole government just does this to get into our private lives. How do you answer that?
It's a specious argument, not based on any facts. If you review the activities and works of the FISA Court, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Court, or you look at what is done day in and day out in courts around the country in terms of approving wire intercepts, you can say it is a very, I would say, rigid. Not rigidity isn't necessarily the word. But very well orchestrated and controlled by a separate branch of government, which is what is unique and which the media never focuses on. We are the only country that gives to a separate branch of government, that is the courts, the approval authority to intercept communications.
Let's move off of electronic surveillance for a minute and move to a different area. In terms of the things that you do, the FBI has done, in addition to having the National Laboratory, which provides for testing, analysis, examination of evidence for the federal government, they also, by the way, do the same for state governments, as I recall, and local agencies on an as-needed basis. But you also have got two other training functions that are quite well established. One is the National Academy for FBI agents down in Quantico, and then there is your own training program at the FBI, same facilities, but for your own agents. That started before you got there, but has the work of those training programs changed since you've been there?
Well, the work our new agents are trained. The training has changed somewhat dramatically in terms of focusing on the role in gathering intelligence, and quite obviously, with the focus turned to counterterrorism, being steeped in counterterrorism when they come out of the academy. How you handle firearms, how you conduct investigations, how you conduct surveillances, and the like has remained fairly much the same. One of the crown jewels of the Bureau, though, is the National Academy. And if you talk to many leaders in state and local law enforcement, particularly those who've been to the Academy, they are tremendously appreciative of that opportunity to spend 10 weeks with other elements of other law enforcement agencies, both domestic and internationally, that provides a bond and a means of developing relationships that will be helpful in the future that just about everybody that goes through the National Academy believes is a huge benefit.
Well, yeah,
and that was one of the things that J. Edgar Hoover put into place that has been tremendously helpful in this day and age in developing the relationships that are so essential to success.
Are you talking about 10 weeks of socialization? Is that the purpose of it? I mean, well, I'd love
10
to,
weeks,
I'd love to, have...
no, it's to get on the same page with things like cyber crimes, the latest threats in the terrorism arena. And so each class, or four classes ago a year, is about 250 strong. And of those 250, probably 20, 25 will come from foreign countries. And you can imagine the importance of having those relationships with the leadership of our counterpart agencies in countries around the globe. It's much the way the military has done mill-to-mill training over a period of time and developed those relationships. They're equally as important in law enforcement, and the National Academy serves that function.
Now let's move on to not just how many agents you have and how their responsibilities are diverse and how the scientific laboratory and your electronic surveillance, but let's talk about the problems, because the 2001 forward, but actually slopping back, I hate to say it, but to before 2001, we've got, as we've already discussed, two or three different aspects of terrorism. First, you've got foreign terrorism. You've got people who come into the United States or attack our people or our interests overseas. So it's done with whatever reason, whether it's revenge or it's to gain a political or military advantage, they attack us overseas. And they do it in different ways, hostage-taking, bombings, kidnappings and assassinations. All of these are events that we've seen not just since 2001, but for many years. That's one area. The second area, and I'm giving you both so you can see if there's any tie-in, you can talk about both. And the second one is homegrown terrorism. We have had the example of Oklahoma City, the bombing of the federal courthouse in Oklahoma City by McVeigh and his friends. We have the Boston Marathon, which we're going to be talking about a little bit later. We have other cases where native-born Americans, we always think, oh, terrorism is those guys overseas. But we have a number of people who in the United States are dissatisfied with how things are going, and they decide to take things into their own hands and use violence or assassination or whatever as a way of getting their way. Or maybe, as it was back in the 1900s, simply they don't like government at all and they're anarchists and they want to figure that anything other than complete total anarchy is really not worthy of the name of human life. So you've got this combination. You've got overseas, you've got local, you've got organizations, and you've got individuals. This is a huge, huge world that we're facing. What are you guys doing about it?
Well, let me start with what I perceive to be the current threats today, which have changed over a period of time since September 11th. As we have had some success in addressing bin Laden and al-Qaeda in the Afghan-Pakistan arena, as all knows, with the growth of ISIS and other such terrorist groups, the threat scenario has changed. Our concern currently with ISIS is that over 100 individuals from the United States have either gone there and come back, or over there, or going there, with the possibility of bringing back new capabilities that can that enable them to undertake terrorist attacks domestically, and present a huge, not a huge, but a large threat to Americans overseas. You also see countries such as Yemen or Libya where there is a vacuum of security and law and order, which also are fertile grounds for launching terrorist attacks against the United States. Along those same lines are the use of social media by ISIS and others to educate, radicalize individuals in the United States, in Europe, and elsewhere to undertake attacks without any lengthy training with a terrorist group overseas. Boston bombers are an example of it. What's happened in Paris recently, they're also another example of this latest iteration. To address this, it really is a sharing of intelligence that is critical to identifying these individuals, being able to identify and follow up on their communications, and also the use of sources to give you an insight into who is doing what, where, who the leadership is, and how best to take them out. The second part that you talk about, and apart from the homegrown, radicalized individuals associated with extreme Islamic ideology, apart from them, and when you talk about what happened in Oklahoma City, those, some call them right-wing extremists, we monitor and develop intelligence capabilities to and make certain that we do our best to identify any nascent plots that would be undertaken either individually or by groups on domestically without any association or affiliation with entities overseas. Again, it goes back to utilizing the intelligence to identify the risks, the threats, the gaps, and then fill those gaps.
Well, Bob, I want to now develop, and we're going to take a break right now, but when we come back, I want to develop some other issues which deal with where we can and where we should not go in terms of developing information from the sources, the places that you've talked about, and in interrogation. So we're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Bob Mueller, who is the recently retired director of the FBI, the second longest after J. Edgar Hoover, director of the FBI, and one who is responsible for watching and helping change the direction that the Bureau and all of federal law enforcement and state law enforcement has taken since 2001. This is John Smetanka, and we are on With Respect. We'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Bob Mueller, the retired director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And this is John Smetanka, and we've been talking, Bob, and I told you I was leading into this. Some areas of interrogation have been getting information from people, have been questioned as to what their efficiency, their effectiveness, and their morality or legality. And I'm going to take the most extreme one that people have talked about and has been got a lot of the news, and that is waterboarding. And does the FBI use that type of enhanced interrogation in its attempt to get information concerning ongoing or future plots?
The Bureau has traditionally, always has traditionally, and continues to this day, to believe that the best method of proceeding in this regard is developing rapport with those individuals from whom you want to obtain information. And that is the heart of what we do.
That comes short of saying that you have not done enhanced interrogation. But is that an accurate statement that you do not?
Well, it depends on. I don't want to get into a dissection of what you mean by enhanced interrogation, but what you mean, that which has been discussed publicly, no, we do not.
All right.
Recently, we do not engage in those techniques. As I say, our focus has been, as an organization, always certainly predating my being there, but while I was there as well, focused on rapport building as the keystone of our interrogation techniques.
Part of your discussion earlier in an earlier show was about changing the relationships between various federal agencies who are responsible for parts and pieces of the of the work that we've been talking about, which is preventing terrorism, preventing criminal acts, and dealing with it once it's happened. And that is the intelligence gathering abilities of the National Security Agency and the both human intelligence and electronic intelligence of the CIA. How does that work in day-to-day reality? I mean, are we talking about a joint command that everybody sees all this intelligence coming to? There's just a huge amount requiring an analysis, collection, and then turning it into some sort of a useful package for decision makers at the in the government. How does that work?
Well, one of the important developments over the years has been the development of the National Counterintelligence Center, a separate center in and of itself that is, when it comes to terrorism, is the entity that has access to, not necessarily pulls in all information, but has access to information across the intelligence community to assure that that intelligence is coordinated, collated, and goes to the appropriate entities to further define the threat and mechanisms of addressing the threat. But the NCIC is a critical component to that sharing of intelligence. On the cyber side, we have the National Cyber Joint Intelligence Center that does much the same thing when it comes to cyber intelligence. And these two entities, the NCIC, or not NCIC, National Center, and the NCIJTF are examples of the sharing amongst the federal agencies that has become so important in the wake of September 11th.
In looking at that world, that as you walked into it in September, and I remember this from my limited experience, there was great tension and fear, as well as by good people. I'm not challenging the integrity of any individuals or institutions, but there was a tension between those agencies, the CIA, the FBI, the Department of Justice, and other entities. Prior to 9/11, I think that sort of created islands, and you got worried about what the other guys were doing, and you just didn't know. And anytime there's a lack of knowledge in what other people are doing, there is the likelihood of either competition or resistance to cooperation. But has that changed?
Well, the it certainly has changed tremendously. In the wake of September 11th, we all knew and understood that the walls had to be broken down, both in terms of statutes, but also in terms of custom. And the Patriot Act broke down those walls and allowed the sharing of information that was not allowed before. And thereafter, it was the relationship between myself and my counterparts at the CIA, but also developing relationships, exchanging personnel that enabled us to break down those walls. Over the last several years, the number two person in the Bureau's National Security Branch has been from the CIA. And when you share personnel and you break down those old concerns that there are about the two agencies. And I think for the last several years, the relationship has been excellent. Development of the mechanisms to share that information has been excellent, and it's as it should be.
Well, you've talked about, you mentioned the USA Patriot Act that was devised and passed by Congress with, I think, a fairly large majority in Congress that has since caused in some areas re-looking at whether or not it gave too much power to government. But overall, does the legislative framework, in your mind, the legislative framework that we are working with, which includes You talked about the FISA court supervising the activities of the executive branch investigators and prosecutors. Is there a balance, or does it need to be changed?
Well, I think in certain areas a balance needs to change. Certainly when it comes to cyber, we need legislation that will give the private sector a safe harbor to provide information on malware and malicious software and other attacks, cyber attacks that they see. That information has to go to the federal government to be looked at with the perspective of that which the federal government has already picked up over a period of time. And Congress needs to pass legislation that will encourage that kind of information sharing. That's one area.
Is the current framework not allowing that kind of safe harbor and cooperation?
It does not. By the way, just as an aside, I should correct myself because I think I said NCIC before when we were talking about terrorism. But what I meant to say was the National Counterterrorism Center, NCTC, not NCIC.
Okay, well, all right. So... that deals with, so far we've dealt with the legislative framework. You say there needs to be some changing to allow more communications. Is that accurate?
Yes. The partnership for addressing the cyber threat is not necessarily between the federal agencies and the state and local law enforcement. That's a component of it, as we had in terrorism. But rather between the federal government agencies and private sector. The private sector are the victims. They're the ones that have the evidence of the intrusions. They're the ones that one has to go through to get the logs and determine who is responsible for particular hacks. And there has to be a mechanism that allows a sharing of that information, and that partnership between the federal agencies and the private sector is absolutely critical to our ability to address this threat.
Is there a block? What's stopping this kind of recognition of the need to share information on what you've just described, which is the cyber attacks on the government? Because it, not only the government, but people.
Private sector.
The private sector. And by recently the Anthem, I think it is the health agency that had its records hacked, and a number of critical pieces, private pieces of information about people's lives, went out the window.
Well, what's holding it up is, Congress, we've got a new Congress, and our hope is that the new Congress will take up this legislation and pass something shortly.
Bob, in the course of your work in the government and your life, you've got to have some thoughts on where are we going, and are we safer today than we were in 2001? Are we safer, or is the world more dangerous?
Well, I think we're safer than 2001 because we put into place, whether it be the FBI or Department of Homeland Security or the CIA, NSA, all of these agencies, and in particular as well, state and local law enforcement are working together in ways that could not even be imagined in September of 2001. So in terms of our defenses and our capabilities to ward off attacks, I think we are far better off than we were in 2001. On the other hand, the developments in North Africa, the Middle East, over the last year have indicated that a retrenched extremist element that has been tremendously effective in recruiting individuals in Syria and Iraq that present a threat such as we have not seen for some time.
Well, we go around the world because so many of the countries and peoples that in the past we could afford to say, well, there's oceans between us. Now, because of travel, because of electronic communications, because of, frankly, weapons of mass destruction, they can affect us, whereas 30 years ago we were basically immune. because of our wonderful the Atlantic Pacific oceans. I'm going to go around the line and ask you, North Korea. North Korea is alleged to have done a tremendous hack on the Sony.
Sony, yes.
What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I can reiterate what has been said in public by Jim Comey, the current director, and the administration in terms of attributing that attack to the North Koreans, and the administration taking steps to address that.
Well, all right. That country has developed methods of mass destruction, nuclear weapons that they have boasted about, and as well are developing the ways to deliver those internationally. Now, I understand that the primary focus for the Bureau is internal, but you do have legats all over the world, legal attachés.
Yes. Yep.
And what role do you play in assessing those kinds of damages, possible damages?
It's relatively small. This is it's not to say that we don't monitor any conceivable activities by North Koreans domestically, because we do. But I would say that the bulk of the intelligence relating to the posture of the North Koreans in terms of activities they are currently taking or will take in the future are in the hands of the those agencies that address international intelligence, whether it be NSA or CIA or others.
Bob, we're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Bob Mueller, the recently retired director of the FBI. This is John Smetanka, and we're on With Respect. We'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Bob Mueller, the recently retired second longest serving director of the FBI, and this is John Smetanka. Bob, when we broke, I was going around the world, and I started with North Korea, and we talked about threats that internally, that is, that you are taking a look at, the Bureau is taking a look at from North Korea or people acting on its behalf, but a lot of attention has been devoted to China. And there, either their people or their agencies or their government or whatever, hacking into our businesses, stealing our secrets, and so on. How does that is that a correct view?
Yes, we indicted 5 or 6 members of the People's Liberation Army in Pennsylvania a number of months ago for their activities in hacking into various U.S. companies and stealing data. Not only is it Congress has held hearings and has published findings with regard to China's activities in this regard, but if you read the indictment in this particular case, it is a strong indictment of the activities of the Chinese in this arena.
One of the entities that we have not talked about, because we've talked about the Middle East, you've talked about Libya, you've talked about Afghanistan and Iraq and a bit about Iran, but one of the countries we haven't talked about may or may not be, if not a threat to us, certainly a concern to us, is Russia. Are there threats there that we have to be concerned about?
I would say the FBI several days ago arrested an individual in New York who was engaged in industrial spying on behalf of the Russian intelligence services. And that is, I believe, an example of the activities of the Russians in terms of, again, wanting to focus and steal and take, whether it be intellectual property in the private sector or in the government to bolster their own capabilities.
How about in Europe, besides Russia? Do we have instances where people, for whatever purpose, from the other European countries, touch us in negative ways?
Using your word, touch us in negative ways, I'd say yes. Who are interested in gathering intelligence and information from us, yes.
What is the role of the FBI in protecting, if you will, the commercial secrets or the business secrets? I'm not talking about governmental secrets and affecting our national policy. I'm talking about the commercial interests. Why are we involved in protecting that?
Well, in terms, it's espionage. It may be industrial espionage, but it's espionage. It's theft. And in the cases where you have foreign countries taking across international boundaries, and you often find other government agencies, that is, those who are hostile to us, setting up front companies and the like that for this specific and sole purpose, gathering this information and putting it back into the military structure of their homelands. And when it's in the United States, we are the ones, the entity that has both the jurisdiction and the capability to undertake those investigations.
Bob, during the course of the past 50 years, there have been various kinds of scandals that have come up that sometimes involve the FBI, sometimes don't, but they cast light, a negative light, on the trustworthiness of our government. I talk about the Church Committee investigations back in the 1970s of the work of the CIA. You can talk about Watergate. You can talk about Arabgate even before that. These are things which happened back in the 60s and 70s. But going on, surveillance of Martin Luther King as a public leader, these are the things which lead people to say, hey, the FBI or government is too intrusive, and they're part of a conspiracy to take away our rights and to deprive us of our privacy or frankly to blackmail our leaders. How do you respond to all that?
Well, I think you mentioned episodes that happened years ago, but yes, has the FBI made mistakes in the past? Absolutely. What you try to do is anticipate those mistakes and learn from those mistakes and try not to replicate them in the future. I will tell you at the outset of in the wake of September 11th, we knew and understood that we would be judged in the future by not just whether we were able to stop terrorist attacks, but that we were able to stop terrorist attacks within the confines of the Constitution, applicable statutes, and the Attorney General guidelines. I gave a speech out on the West Coast in 2002 early on, which is how I ended up. I said, we know and understand that there is a balance here. And day in, day out, we keep our eye on that balance. Every agent that goes through the National Academy is steeped in constitutional law and what the Constitution allows and what the Constitution does not allow. And finally, thanks to Louis Free, who put it into place this initiative, every agent goes through the Holocaust Museum with the purpose of bringing home to that agent the fact that an agency such as ours that goes rogue is devastating, and to keep in mind the necessity for continuing to keep our activities well within the applicable constitutional provisions and statutes.
We want safety in our world. The bigger the world, the more interconnected it becomes, the more events pound on us every day through the news. The more we keep trying to get our arms around it and protect our families and our own sanity, we're looking for safety. Is there such a thing today as safety?
It's all relevant. It's all relevant depending on what you're talking about and particular circumstances you're talking about. I think 99.999% of the American public feel that we are safe day in and day out. Certainly there are concerns about terrorism. Certainly there are concerns about cyber threats. Certainly there are concerns about violent crime. But if you look at various aspects of the landscape, you will see that we are safer in most of our major cities because crime has diminished dramatically in most of our major cities over the last 10 years. So day in, day out, if you live in a major city which had a huge large homicide rate in the past, you could probably look at the statistics today, and that has been halved, if not quartered. And so in some ways we're safer, and in other ways there are threats out there that we have to address, whether it be terrorism or in the cyber arena.
Bob, what are you doing these days? Are you retired and watching the soap operas on television, eating bonbons?
No, that's a far cry from what I'm doing. I am doing some speaking, doing some teaching, and also with a firm, Wilmer Hale, and doing work with regard to cyber response, cyber preparation, and then internal investigations.
Well, we're going to, unfortunately, going to run out of time fairly soon, but there is a pressing question. Our mutual friend and boss years ago, Bill Barr, rather, was Attorney General of the United States for about a year and a half, and in my view would have been the best Attorney General in the 20th century had he had a little bit more time. He would have been recognized as such. I have a great deal of respect for him. However, one time he came out and talked to my daughter's school out here in St. Joseph, a little Catholic school in Lake Michigan Catholic. And so he addressed the middle school and the grammar school. And after he talked about the work of the Department of Justice and the FBI, because he was boss of both, he said, "Are there any questions?" And so what happened? One kid, the first kid, raised his hand and said, "Mr. Attorney General, are there really things called X-Files?" So, and that, of course, we know from the TV show that X-Files are about extraterrestrial life and flying saucers and invasions from Mars and whatnot. So I put it to you, former director Robert Mueller, and for a candid answer, are there such things as X-Files?
Never seen the show.
Now that is Washington evasion of the answer. All right. All right. Bob, thank you very much for your time, your insights. Any final statement as to what this whole thing has meant to you, this whole life that you've had to this point of public service and work with the FBI, a great institution with its blemishes, but a great institution nonetheless. Any final assessments?
No, only that I've been exceptionally lucky to have the opportunity to work with the people in the FBI and the Department of Justice and also in the law firms over a period of time. Tremendously lucky. And as you know and I know, part of it's attributable to my wife, so I could not leave without giving credit where credit is due. Never could have done it without her.
And I know your wife well, and I agree that you are the luckiest thing that ever happened to you is meeting Anne, because she is a charming person and a pillar of strength to anybody around her. So congratulations for that luck. I don't say judgment. I just say that luck.
It was. We didn't know what we were doing.
Okay. Thanks, Bob Mueller.
Okie doke. Thanks, John.
Thank you. This is Bob Mueller. He has been our guest. He was the former director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation nationally and internationally, involved in law enforcement and keeping us safe. The name of our program is With Respect. And until next time, remember our mantra: if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.